So today is the 11th of October, and this is the class on Yasutani Roshi's text. Okay.
So in the last, very last paragraph from last time, so it's page 14.
Yes.
Right. Since it is indeed difficult to be born as a human being, do not miss this opportunity. Having the correct aspiration and determination to be enlightened in this marvelous Buddha nature, that is the important thing.
Yes.
So this is beautiful. I love the reminder that, you know, it isn't easy to be born human. You know, we take it for granted, but I know Joko used to talk about it's like, you know, you pick up a grain of sand, you know, sand is like one of these grains, you know, it's just not... that's probably, I don't know how to express that best, but it was a similar concept like she was saying. But at any rate, it says the second line, though, having the correct aspiration and determination to be like, so, you know, that's a little bit more, it's sort of sound like he's saying, you know, there is something.
To aspire to, and a determination to go through what's hard in order to be, let's say I switch the word enlightened to the word to awaken to what is so. Remember, he's been saying all along, you know, if you remember, we just finished the discussion on this very page about this Buddha nature itself, which is the fundamental cause of all life, is the way if I put it that way. And the capacity to be able to realize this. So, and yet for some reason, we find all sorts of ways that we don't see what our life is, as a result of believing habits of all sorts, which is what he's going to start dealing with in the very next chapter, which he titles or is entitled Misconception of Self. So that's what he means by that. So it's that there is something for us to do. Not because there has to be something for us to do, but that circumstances, or say cause and effect, or say habits, or say tendencies, whichever way you explain it, we don't see or live who and what we really are, and therefore there's something for us to do to cease doing what gets in the way of us being who we are, or being what our life is, and our life isn't just so-called my life, but the life of all that we encounter. So by us doing it, we're enabling everyone and everything that we encounter to also be what they are, who they are, or who we are, better word to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's all.
Anyone else want to bring up something before we start on the next chapter, the next section, section 2, Misconception of Self, which is page 15. No? Okay. So, the very first paragraph there, I want to clarify a bit where he says, since Buddha nature is non-self, there is no specific entity, the self. Yet this I concept is so deeply rooted in our thinking that we persist in erroneously considering ourselves to be separate entities. And this, the purpose of this chapter is to correct this, or at least to clarify this critical misunderstanding. So when he's saying there, if I sort of elaborate, I'll say it's no fixed, permanent, separate self. So, to add those clarifies, because of course, I say, such and such. Eliu did such and such. No problem with saying I, no problem with using my name, saying Genmyo was ordained in such and such time, or it's the fact that we consider ourselves and others as separate entities, as permanently and fixed, permanent in some sense, separate fixed entities, and therefore we believe things about others because they're so-and-so. They are this way, and they are that way, and they're separate from me, and they are doing these things to me. And because of that, we cling to all sorts of likes and dislikes about them, about ourselves, about should and shouldn't, about me, about should and shouldn't, about them. And it could be thems close to us that we know, or could be thems out on the world stage, who we have all sorts of stories as if we know them and as if they are a fixed, separate entity, instead of seeing how they and we are just this Buddha nature, which manifests in all sorts of ways, and therefore what we do about it. So, the next point I'm going to bring up, and then I want to stop and let you, is in the very next paragraph. From the Buddhist point of view, however, all objects, living and non-living, or non-living, are none other than the root of consciousness itself. This root of consciousness manifests itself in animal-like, in animals, inanimate-like, in inanimates, and so forth. This is very important. In other words, all are none other than the manifestation at their root, the of cause and effect arising of Buddha nature or consciousness itself. That's what he's saying. Now, that's not so easy for us because we tend to evaluate and privilege certain things over others and emphasize differences and so forth. And then he, of course, this is generalities, and we just have to accept that they're generalities, but we don't have to, we could explore it further. And then he talks about whether it's inanimate, from our point of view, inanimate, whether it's even things like processes, he talks about flowing of water, burning of fire, etc., etc., not just the water itself or the mountains or the rocks. And then he starts with plants, and he goes from there. Now, we have to know that this is simplified. So, for instance, he talks about plants and desire of life, and he talks about struggle for existence, and he says it doesn't involve combative behavior. That's sort of simplifying, at least what we know now as compared to what he knew. I mean, we have to remember, he grew up in the first half of the 20th century, so a lot of what we know now, he did not know. Plus, he doesn't really have a scientific background in that sense. So now we know that plants do have what we could call combative behavior, though it's on a different scale, different timeline, different ways, under the earth and in the air with chemicals, etc. And it's different than what we humans sense. And at the same time, there's much more of a interrelations and symbiotic behavior among plants as opposed to combative behavior. I've talked about this before. I know a little bit because my son's scientific study is in this area. But if you're interested, and I've mentioned this to some of you, there's a recent novel that in some ways deals with aspects of the science of tree and fungi and all the others, And also it deals with what sort of the speculative edges of the science, which my son will argue is not yet verified by scientific research. An interesting, this is a book called The Overstory by someone who used to be at Illinois, University of Illinois in Champaign. I don't know if he still is, Champaign-Urbana. His name was Richard Powers. His name is Richard Powers, and the book is called The Overstory. Okay, I will stop here. I have more to say about as we go down about what he's saying here, but I'd like to let, before I continue talking, I want to let you all bring up, if you have what you want to, how you want to respond, how you understand what he's saying, how you have a sense of it, what connects to you, what doesn't connect for you. Yeah, you have to speak closer to wherever the mic is because I can only barely hear you.
This is Delinda.
Yes.
And has your son talked also about the secret life of trees?
Yes. I mean, as far as he's concerned, some of that is not scientifically proven yet. It's somewhat speculative, but that's okay.
Yeah, okay. But I thought that book was more of a scientific...
Well, that person is a forester, if I remember correctly, some of it is true and some of, let me say it differently. Some of it scientists will agree with and some of it they'll say is speculation, but not yet proven.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. But, you know, scientists argue about these things and then they discover 10, 20 years later that there is proof for it or there isn't. But, yeah, all sorts of things. I mean, it's the same. I mean, Yasutani somewhat simplifies when he talks about herbivorous animals as being peace-loving. In a way, you know, he talks about herding insects and principally dealing with it in terms of protection and defense, but the fact of the matter is we know very well there's violence and viciousness among herbivorous animals, whether it's wild bison or wild horses or sheep or goats or all the other antelopes. Often connected with sexual controls because there tends to be one dominant male who wants to have his harem of females and fights off competitors. There's dominance issues of the herd, and this is true for all sorts of herbivorous creatures, moose, antelope, deer, and we know about the vicious rutting behavior, but that's okay. From outside, it seems quite extreme, and yet this is exactly the life natural way, an evolutionary way. So there's all sorts of behaviors there, and there are all sorts of natural reactiveness and self-protections, dominance, especially when animals are feel threatened. And this is also true for what we don't think so much of as herbivorous, even though they are elephants and rhinos, hippos and mice, voles, etc. So that's... And including killing of rivals of all sorts. So it's not just true for, it's not true that horses, oxen, cows, deer, sheep are peaceable creatures who flock together in the interest of safety. That's simplifying. And it's also true that, you know, all sorts of behavior among lions and tigers and birds, etc. So, anyway, I just wanted to make that point. But he just goes through that and pointing out that these are also all manifestations of how he sees Buddha nature. It's just there's different forms, and different forms manifest in different ways according to cause and effect, both in terms of what they're born with and what they do.
Daniel?
Yes.
Hey, interrupt. This chapter, Misconception of the Self.
Yes.
He takes it from a point of view of, you know, and it's certainly true that we see ourselves as distinct entities separate from other people, from things. But I think there's also, in a sense, we see ourselves as being separate from ourselves. And we say things like, I have emotions and I have thoughts.
Yes.
As if these things are, you know, a part of the outside world that we interact and deal with. And if you look at that closely, it really gives a good clue of how we misunderstand and how we use this concept of self in kind of a narrow and misguided way. And the other thing I wanted to mention, since we're on this page, is I don't want to be unfair to Yasutani here, but if he's implying in his words that this kind of panpsychism perspective.
What does panpsychism mean?
Panpsychism is where the concept that consciousness is a fundamental reality.
Well, you've got to be careful what the word consciousness means. I mean,
yes, that's the point I was going to make. I think he's kind of looking to redefine consciousness
from the
way we normally think.
Right. Remember, this is a translation done in the 60s, and I don't think they would translate it as consciousness in the sense that there's one so-called consciousness, but the nature of manifesting awareness, if we say it that way. But remember, it included rocks and running water, etc. So it's all Buddha nature, and maybe consciousness isn't the best word for that, because...
From a certain perspective, you can say this is certainly true, because rocks are minerals, and minerals form, the minerals form chemicals, and chemicals form molecules, and molecules, you know, form biology, and biology forms life, and life forms human beings, and human beings have consciousness. So minerals, in that sense, certainly do, as an emergent property, create consciousness.
Well, we have to be careful. When we say human beings have consciousness, even that we're not quite clear about, especially as we do research in the whole process of what it is that creates consciousness and what it is that is human beings. When you look more closely, you see human beings is really a collection of all sorts of bacterial organisms, no, I should say it differently, microbiological organisms, and some of which we could call bacteria and some of which we can call parts of other genus and species. And it's not at all clear, but I don't think it's that important for us to go into the detail of that. Even in terms of humans, when we look at the behavior, the emotions, the neurobiology and psychology is constantly being examined from a scientific point of view, but he's not trying to go into all that. I mean, if you're interested, I'm just reading a book called Behave by a... it's called Behave, the Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst by someone, Robert M. Sapolsky.
Sapolsky, yes. Yeah. I'm a big fan of his, yes.
Can I just ask you a really basic question, which, you know, I've been coming to Zen classes for a long time. Why is it true that there is no self?
Okay.
How do we know that's true? I mean, I can see where everything is kind of made up of the same particles and all of that kind of floats around, but there is why is there no self? Why is that true?
Remember what I said about there's no self. I said there's no fixed, permanent, separate self.
Well, what does it mean? I mean, separate in what sense? I mean, I understand from a scientific standpoint that we're all made up of the same thing, but there is...
No. It's not. There isn't a scientific point of view that we're all made up from the same thing. But in terms of self, meaning first that there's a ongoing selfness, more than just me saying I now, but the I now is the I of yesterday and is the I of last week and is the I of tomorrow. And that this I is somewhere inside me or inside this skin and bones, and it's separate from the world around me and the other beings around me.
Well, it's like consciousness. There is no consciousness without conscious of. If anything, you wouldn't be conscious.
No, but I understand that this self changes, even from a scientific standpoint, that cells are constantly dying and new ones are coming up and I'm changing and experiences and cause and effect. But why am I not a separate self from Ed?
Well, you are.
So what is no self? The concept of no self is just that myself is in constant change. I thought that no self meant there's not even a separateness from others
You're still on humans. In one sense, the idea of a fixed, separate, permanent self that I could call Eliu is dependent on a whole bunch of cause and effects that come together at this moment, but this moment is not the same Eliu as yesterday, as last week, as tomorrow, and that Eliu even right now doesn't exist here in California, because you're also hearing Eliu in Champaign and Springfield in the Midwest, and that Eliu is seeing the sunlight here that's 90 plus a million miles away, and the trees out here, and this room that Eliu is sitting in, etc., etc. All of that is Eliu of this moment, or Genmyo of this moment. Is it Genmyo or is it Eliu? It's both and I and neither. It's
I can understand that, and I think that that's true. I don't understand why I am separate from Ed. I'm separate from Delinda. I can see how I'm an ever-changing.
Who is the I that is the ever-changing?
Well, I guess there is no I if it's ever-changing. But this ever-changing energy that's sitting here is different from Ed's ever-changing energy sitting over there. That energy.
In one sense, it is. Yeah.
So I mean.
Wait, the difference. Doesn't it make for selfness? Selfness doesn't mean that there aren't variations, so that just like you could have fire and wood, but the fire doesn't have a selfness separate from the wood that's burning, and yet the wood and the fire are different. both in terms of chemical properties and energy properties, just on that simple level. Yet at the moment there's burning, is which is it? Is it wood or is it fire? Even part of it is this dualism that's built into most beings, which is what he's talking about. He's talking about that's the misconception of self, or that's an aspect of it. But there's also a sense of relatedness that's also built in.
It's not a sense of misconception. It's a sense of misinterpretation. I mean, on page 16, in the middle, he says, what is the essential wisdom? You see that?
Yes.
He says, what is it that he must realize? He must realize his Buddha nature. That is, he must come to know as a fact that the self is only illusion. But an illusion is a real thing.
Well, it's...
just misconstrue the illusion as being something other than what it is.
I'm never going to get Buddha nature because to me, it seems true that this thing of energy that's sitting in this chair right here is ever changing. And that it intersects with all the rest of the energy in here, but it's still a separate.
How is it separate? If for a moment you weren't breathing air, let's say it that way, of course you would die. So you have to be connected to the air, right?
Yes.
If you didn't hear the vibrations in the air, whatever that means, you wouldn't be hearing me and you couldn't respond to me. So you're connected.
But isn't that interconnection? That's interconnection within separateness. That's not... It's not that this thing of energy sitting in this chair is not distinct. It's just that it intersects with everything else and is connected. But I just have always struggled with this,
right?
You know, self.
The problem is, if I say it this way, is that we tend to think it's either or-ness. So when you say it's distinct, sure, it's distinct and it's interconnected. And the distinctness always is based on an interconnectedness, and the distinction is based on a always changingness. So the distinctness keeps changing from having once been an egg and sperm that came together, but before that, where was it? Who knows? And it came together and it keeps on changing. And the sense of the distinction changes from being inside the womb when it's separate and yet it's interconnected with the placenta and the mother and the sounds in the womb and the amniotic fluid, etc. And then we're out here, whatever out here is, and breathing air, and so we're connected with the air, and yet we're separate. And we see people when we open our eyes, or we see something, and what we see, is it separate from us or not? It's not an either-or-ness. So therefore, there's no problem in being distinct, but knowing that the distinction is only one side or one facet of it, and the distinction doesn't exclude the interdependence and interbeingness. It's when we emphasize just one aspect, one facet of, let us say, the distinction, then we lose track that there's another side where that distinction is interrelated, is not distinct. See, so we could include what seems to be contradictory because we want to do it in as either or. See, we want to say if there's dualism, it can't be monism. And if there's separateness, then there can't also be relatedness. And yet it's the interrelatedness that includes the separateness. So you can have the zero, if you want to go back to that story, as being below the line, so to speak, and the one above the line. But whenever you have one above zero, it always equals infinity. So the one can keep changing. The one can seemingly be an infant sometimes and a teenager another times and an older person another time, then a senior citizen and then a dead corpse. But it's always over the zero. And if it's always over the zero, then it's always just different ways that the zero is manifesting, if I use that kind of imagery.
It feels more true to me to talk about interbeing, which is...
Yeah.
It is, realizing all the connectedness, not seeing any of it as other, but still... Because it's this unrealistic goal you put for yourself that practice has to feel like dropping the way of self. And when you read these texts,
No. Forgetting the self, not dropping away, so that you're not blinded by this. But of course, I'm always going to speak with a New York accent till I stop speaking, and then I'll either mumble, or I'll be completely demented, or I'll be dead. But as long as I'm speaking, unless I go through some major voice training, etc., I'm going to speak with a New York accent. It's just cause and effect. However, that doesn't make me a New Yorker, or it doesn't make me a New Yorker to the exclusion of all the other aspects of me. See, it's the either-or-ness, because we tend to emphasize the self as being this particular form. And it's the being able to let go of that so that when sensations, feelings, beliefs come up that bang up against the ones that we hold to in a self-centered way, because circumstances are different, we don't have to react with anger or sadness or upset or viciousness or greed. See, that's the point here, if we do it that way. See?
So, are you trying to forget, well, I don't even know if this is the right word, forget the self? Brings you closer to other people and more understanding. I mean, is that the purpose?
Well,
I keep going back to your image that you've used in the past of that net, Indira's net. Is this the jewels?
Yes.
I think of that often because I think of, different aspects of life, different aspects of people, it helps me to try to be more patient, more understanding, thinking that they're not separate from me.
Uh-huh.
Especially when I see the news, when I see people suffering in other countries. So is this a way to help us to be more compassionate?
Okay. Yes, but let me go to something on the next page, and then I'll come back, because I have some. So on the very next page, this is page 16, the first paragraph on the next page, 17, where he says, to further explain the seeming, notice that, opposition between self and non-self, I say that the two factors involved are self and the circumstances of self. The self and the circumstances of self may appear to be different and may appear to oppose each other. And this is exactly what Debbie, what we're getting at there. But no self can exist without circumstances, and no circumstances can exist without self. This is a fact, and in this respect, the world may be called a monist world, or a world of one perfect circle. This is the real world in which all existence lives as Buddha nature. Fortunately, we are able to see, and when he uses the word see, I will say experience this world for ourselves, and then it makes sense. But notice, this doesn't contradict Debbie, you saying, I'm Debbie, and I have a sense of self. Fine, but Debbie only exists in a universe which is also Debbie. And then sometimes Debbie speaks as Debbie, and sometimes Debbie listens to, I forgot your boss's name. I'm sorry. It'll come.
She had to leave.
Debbie left?
There is no self called Debbie here.
Lisa is your boss.
Oh, okay. Lisa Madigan. So sometimes the circumstance of Debbie is Lisa Madigan right there. And that's the circumstance of self when she's speaking. And yet, how not to get stuck in the Debbie so that we could listen to someone else. Because if we're stuck in ourself, then we only listen to the other person in terms of how they fit or don't fit or confirm or conflict with what we think they should be saying or shouldn't be saying. But we'll come back to this, because I think on this page 17, he tries to elaborate a little more. Now, of course, it's important to know that conceptually understanding this and understanding this from the inside out through our own experiencing is very different, which is why Zazen isn't about thinking about all this, but this moment experiencing until we, if I use the word awaken or realize for ourselves bit by bit in different ways or all at once or whatever, what our life is. That's what it's all about. It's not about reading this and then saying, okay, I agree with him, so okay, I'm all awakened, etc., and there's no more problems. If it's true, that's great, but despite reading this, we still tend to miss interbeing, miss interrelatedness, miss it when there's ongoing changes that we don't like and we react to them. Then all of a sudden, we've missed the non-fixedness and really believe that the way I think it should be is the way it is. And yet somehow the universe doesn't follow my instructions. Or the way I think it should be is the only perfect way, and then somehow the perfection of the universe isn't following my instructions, since it's always changing. And I tend to have an idea which, you know, I've determined is how it should be. And therefore, if it's not that way, I should get angry, I should get upset, I should get depressed, etc. Which we do just so automatically. That's the whole caught in self-centered dreamness. I didn't mean to speak too much. Again, I'll stop and see what you want to say more. And we'll continue with this on page 17 next time. But let me stop. And
well, I just finished reading that book that you mentioned a few weeks ago. I think it's called On the Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli.
Yes. You're going to make trouble for people.
And he was saying that that things are, you know, there are no things, as we usually would like to make, you know, believe that there are, because it's easier to deal with things, because he says all these things are really events.
Yes. Now, remember, he's talking.
When I think of that, really sort of not think about, I mean, not so much trying to conceptualize, but try to, like, feel how that might be or how that looks like if, when you look at something like a football game or any other particularly long event that takes up time and is changing all the time, and it you know, it's always internally changing, and also it's got the its little bubble in which it exists that's always interacting with other stuff too, and it's sort of like these what did you say, it's a Zen box or something, or someone a week ago said something about these Zen diagrams or Venn diagrams. It's sort of like everything is sort of like interacting.
Yes.
Everything. So it's and so that it gets really kind of confusing about where if there's anything we try to focus on some one particular thing when it's always, when you can't do it that way. It just,
yeah.
By convention, of course, you know, conventionality, we say, you know, pass the bread or the butter or whatever, but it's always in, it's kind of very slippery, but you know, but it's, anyway, that event thing, it's really, it kind of intrigues me.
Yeah, now, I should mention that the author you mentioned is a quantum physicist, and the book you're reading or read had to do with the nature of being and time, and the fact that being and time, each being has its own particular time, and each time has its own particular being, and he goes on to talk about this all from a scientific point of view, which is very different from the, what you might call the mechanical physics point of view, which is very ordinary, of separation of things and a continuous flow of time. So I don't want to go into that because that's, some of that is beyond me. Some of it I could understand a little.
Yeah, I understand most of the stuff you was talking about, but just that particular.
Yes. Yes.
I thought it was valuable.
Sounds like music to me.
Yeah, music the same way.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, music
is an event.
And music is an event that doesn't just occur in one place, but extends in all directions and extends, is interconnected with the, what should I say? If I say it this way, the instruments that produce the music, the beings that make the music, the food that feeds the beings, that gives them the energy, and so forth, as well as the paper upon which the scores are written, and the writer, and the, and go on and on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, in one sense, it's easy to understand conceptually. In another sense, it's very difficult for us because we constantly want to, if I say it this way, get caught up in self-centered dream, because that gives us a justification for getting upset or getting hurt or feeling gain or loss, and then all the things that come from that sort of conflict, and those sorts of likes and dislikes. It's like Yasutani says at the last paragraph, and I'll stop here at that point, on page 16. He says, some scholars believe that conflict is inevitable, and he goes on and he says it's like persons who, when he sees two hands moving in the opposite directions to tear a piece of paper, believes on the basis of what he's seeing that these are two separate things, hands, are opposing each other, forgetting that the most important or important fact is, after all, the two hands are one person ripping a piece of paper. We tend to want to focus on the hand that we are, and we focus on the hand that we're not, so to speak, as opposing us. And it seems from our point of view most natural, which is why, in a sense, practice is about being able to be that, what we focus on, and yet being able to open up more. That's why we have to discover it for ourselves, because just explaining it constantly gets bombarded by all the ways we insist our story of likes and dislikes and yes and no and the duality that we believe our life is, and that everyone else we believe is telling us and assuring us is true. And our society is assuring us is true. That's the whole point about greed and anger and all the rest. So, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time, unless you have something that absolutely you want to bring up now and you won't remember till next week. I would like us to return to this next week. We could continue with stuff, or not stuff. We can continue with some of what he says on page 16, and then go on to page 17, etc. So that's, as I said, these chapters are going to take us a while to go through. So we're still in that chapter 2, part A, but we're partially through it. If you have comments, questions, feel free to bring them up. And I'm not trying to rush through anything or skip over anything. And I think it's valuable for us to keep chewing on this. Anyone have anything else they want to say? Well, I'll take that we could stop here. Is that okay? Okay, we're going to have a Zazen Kai on Saturday. Yes?
Yes.
Looks like it.
Okay, so I'll speak to some of you either Saturday or Sunday, and if not, I'll speak to you, the universe willing, next Thursday. Bye.
Good night.
Bye. Bye.